I want to ask you a couple of questions about the book and some samples of some of your humor, but tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I come from... I studied philosophy in school. I used to write articles on epistemology for philosophy journals, graduate school.
But where did you go to school?
Pardon me?
Where did you go to school?
I went to Trinity College in Hartford and Columbia and NYU, and the golden age of philosophy at NYU when Sidney Hook was there and William Barrett and Paul Edwards. Then I went into the business world, and for about 20 years I was working in the investment community. And about 7 years ago, as I was going down the tube in the stock market, I wrote a little humor book about Wall Street. And then I started writing seriously and did some nonfiction for the women's magazines and what have you. And then tried some humor and found that the better places liked my humor. So that I think Over the Transom, the first thing I ever sold was a piece to Harper's, and then followed by one to the New York Times, and then shortly thereafter I sent a piece cold to Punch in London, and they didn't take it, but they wrote me back a note saying they liked the gently loony lilt of my writing. They're a very unique bunch over there. And before long I was writing regularly for Punch, and I think I'm the only person who's ever published humor in 5 different sections of the New York Times. A minor but important credit. And
this doesn't include the classified ads.
No. No. In any event, it's been building for the last 7 years, and I rearranged my whole life. I didn't allow for inflation, but I did rearrange my whole life.
You're no longer in the business world?
No. I do a little investing on the side, but... I'm pretty much a full-time writer.
And personal investing or for others?
Personal investing. And
everybody does that. I mean, even I have a CD.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to make it writing. And this book, this is my big shot. It's been received well, and I'm having a wonderful time. You know, even if I don't make it financially, I'm having the greatest time of my life.
Is this your second book?
Well, the first one was a kind, what today they characterize as a non-book. I did a book of Wall Street terms using a format like Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary. Since then, I might add, Workman Press and a lot of others have all used this dictionary format, and it all really kind of... mine was there in 1970, but I wasn't writing in a serious way at that time, and so I think of this as my first book. This is my first collection, anyway, and this should catapult me into contention. At least McGraw-Hill sees it that way.
Are these are collections of all of the various things you've written over the last couple of
years?
This
book, How to Raise Your IQ by Eating Gifted Children, is a collection of 50 short pieces, that about half of which have appeared in Punch and the Times and Harper's and what have you, and about half of which are new. The title piece, which includes recipes from Columbia Teachers College, was outrageous, and they felt, well, this would attract a lot of attention, which it has. I'm just hoping I don't attract any attention from some rabid anti or pro-children group. It might be controversial.
Well, when I saw the title, I thought it was a serious book.
Yeah,
there are so many books on how to raise children. I looked at it. Well, maybe you can raise a kid's IQ by eating him.
Yeah, maybe you can. I worry, lest someone out there take it seriously. But it's a send-up of you are what you eat. Planarian worms seem to retain memory when they eat a fellow who had a good memory. Learned a trick, and they can do the trick.
Well, I was surprised that you had sold material to Punch, not because you couldn't write the material, but because in my mind, I wondered if British humor was somewhat different from
ours. British humor is different from American humor, and I've wondered the same thing. I don't write for the British market. I mean, I don't consciously make an effort to mimic British writing. I just write what pleases me, and for some reason they like it. Though the character of Punch is British and wonderful group of people like Basil Boothroyd and Jonathan Sale and Miles Kington. They're brilliant over there. Yet every time Punch has tried to market the magazine here, it does sell here, but to the Harvard Club and international bookstores and things, but they've never been able to carve out a large part of the American market because it's a dry humor and it does different character from American humor. Conversely, American humor does well in Great Britain. They're very familiar with the American humorous. But you don't see, it's, for some reason, it doesn't fly here as well.
But that's a very accurate perception that you have. I was talking last week to Paul Theroux, who is a well-known American travel writer who lives in, a novelist who lives in England.
If I could interrupt you for a second, Paul Theroux had a piece in Punch in the very issue I did not long ago, and I was surprised to see him because he's one of the few Americans I've ever seen appear there. And he wrote a funny piece. It was a very clever piece.
His new book is a rather devastating look at the British called The Kingdom of the Sea.
Yes.
You've read it. And one thing that he says in this book is that the English love American culture. For example, I noticed on Showtime the other night, Dean Martin was given an hour special, a performance that he did in a concert hall in England. And Dean Martin's period has passed in the United States. I mean, he's no longer funny. His humor isn't funny. He wasn't funny. And I watched part of the show, and it wasn't funny. Mm-hmm. But the English audience just loved it.
Yeah.
And they love American singers. They love American television shows.
Mm-hmm.
They love American comedians. So I guess it would not be unusual that they would like your material as well.
Somehow they've embraced me and consider me family now, and I'm very pleased. I've never been to London, or I haven't been to London, let's say, since 1958, and I have this fantasy that I have a great following in London, and it's possible that I might. And whatever it is, I'm very happy about it. And the Punch people Punch is the oldest humor magazine in the world, and they have a large mahogany table, similar to the one we're sitting at, a round table, where through the decades, many famous humorists and writers have carved their names in this table. Mark Twain and Thackeray and Thurber. And
they ought to be arrested.
Yeah, and it's sort of
facing private property like
that's
that.
That's true, and they have little private luncheons after. In fact, I think the New Yorker modeled some of their practices after what takes place in Punch and at the Punch Roundtable.
Let me ask you a little bit about your humor, some of which is quite outrageous. How does this relate to your life? Do you wake up in the morning and see something funny as soon as you open your eyelids?
It's funny. I'm not one of those people that writes regularly and has to put aside so many hours a day to write. I write humor inspirationally. Sometimes you're just incubating. Something strikes me as funny, and I think about it for a day or two. And when it comes out full-blown, like in one whole piece, just writes itself, and it's almost like a gestation period between the time I think of it and it comes out. And then I sit at the typewriter, and I sit there alone in this room, chuckling and roaring at the typewriter.
What
I have this fear one day you'll come in and carry me away.
What about in a group of people? Do you tend to try to be funny then, or do you come
out? I've never been a clown or an exhibitionist. I was not the class clown in high school. I do well when like if I go to the movies with my brother and we quip back and forth to one another. But I'm not, I'm not comedic in a performing sense. It's kind of like a private world. I write for myself and then I try to find a market for it afterwards. Fortunately, there have been a few places that like my stuff. But it's a very private world. And things strike, I read something, I hear something, a notion strikes me, usually a little zany or dotty, and I sooner before long it becomes a piece.
When you write short pieces as you do, do you have an agent, or do you try to send these out on your own?
Until the book, I never used an agent. I sold everything I've ever written, and that includes a lot of work for magazines and a lot of nonfiction and non-humor. I've sold everything I've ever written over the transom cold. With the book, I did take an agent, Dorothy Pittman, who did the preppy book and some on the Dieter's Guide to Sex and White Love. She's very good. She loves humor. She's this wonderful Southern woman, and she sold the book right off, and we've had a lot of fun with it, doing it, and you know, she's just wonderful and protects my interests. And
well, let's explore some of the humor. One piece in here that particularly amused me because it was so timely was your proposal for an invasion of Cuba. It's so timely and so newsworthy. I wonder if I could just ask you, not to read it, but just to tell me what you would do if you were the Reagan administration and you would like to invade Cuba. How would you pull it off? 125.
I will tell you. I'll tell you something interesting about that piece, actually. It's interesting that you picked that. It's also fascinating to me. Different. Everybody loves a different piece. This was the first piece I sold to Punch. And they had actually called me and asked me, could I do a Cuban invasion piece? Would I be willing to try something like that? And I said, of course, I've always wanted to invade Cuba. And I sat down and I thought about it, and this thing came out. And it was around 1976, not 77, not long after the actual Bay of Pigs thing. And it struck me what could be funny about how would you invade Cuba? So I thought of, well, you could come in a dirigible, a blimp disguised as an Havana cigar, and if we wore sneakers, it would be quiet, and Castro wouldn't notice us, and that sort of thing. And it's actually a quite subtle piece. It's not some of these pieces can be read aloud and performed. Others not. This is I don't know whether this one can.
Well, I think this one you ought to mark and send to the White House. Tell me a little bit about Bunny Burgermeister loves books.
Right, Bunny Burgermeister was actually it was after several visits to the Strand Bookstore and Books Incorporated here in New York, and I based this on these wonderful proprietors of the new Book Emporia, which are these, you go in and the paneled walls, and they make you the music playing, and they have the books laid out, and they're...
You're not talking about the Strand.
Well, not so much. I was thinking of Books Incorporated. The Strand is also a wonderful...
The Strand's a large... Books to go down.
You're right. But I was thinking of...
Book in a window.
But the Strand has a little upstairs nook where they keep their rare and special books, and... So I took Bunny Burgermeister, this fictitious character who was arrested in his youth for foxing and doing all sorts of bad things to books, and who grew up and lived out his family. He has a little place in the store called the Book Nook, where he allows people to come in and live out their fantasies. There's some people who like to just play with octavos and the little small books, and a lot of them who just like to expurgate privately in a room, and I took it and went on from there, and had a lot of fun with it. I think book proprietors will enjoy that piece.
I think so too. Well, give me a final example of your choosing of one of the pieces here that you think may be typical of the humor that you have how to raise your IQ by eating your children.
I think wedding announcements. I just always. Love the society pages in the Times or other papers around the country. Actually, this particular piece appeared in Louisville, Kentucky. But they're, in a sense, they're self-parodies. But one can go a step further. And if I may read you one or two of these little wedding announcements that appeared, you might find them amusing. This is the Frick popover wedding. Mr. and Mrs. Van Wyck Frick have announced the engagement of their daughter, Dudu, to Mr. C. Livingston Popover, who manages his own trust. Dudu, who is known to her friends as Puff Puff, or to her very close friends as Dee Dee, or to the senior class at Dartmouth as Easy, attended Miss Pinball's school in South Braintree, where she was voted most likely to become pregnant during inclement weather. Her grandfather, Colonel Summerfield Frick, invented the cummerbund and was chairman of the Frick Formal Wear Corp, which dispensed free cummerbunds to our troops during the Vietnam War. Her father, Van Wyck Frick, runs a polo league for advantaged children in Palm Beach. Mr. Popover is the son of Pop Popover, the World War II ace who was twice decorated by President Truman and later sent to Leavenworth Penitentiary for shooting down four civilian aircraft en route to Miami Beach. His mother is the former Abigail Oaktop, whose family has large holdings in real estate, banking, and the United States government. The couple plan a June wedding. And that's kind of... here's one other short one. Allison P. Worth, engaged to nobody. Allison P. Worth, daughter of Admiral and Moneybags Turner P. Worth, has become affianced to Jeffrey Sider, a nobody. Miss P. Worth, who attended Hollyville Academy, Le Nevreuse in Geneva, and Bennington College, where she was graduated magna cum laude in creative movement, is working at the Morgan Guaranty Trust Bank in New York as a blank check. Her maternal grandfather, Hoghorn Pill, discovered money. The couple plan to be married in June and honeymoon aboard the family yacht, the USS Lexington, etc. And each of them, they're nice to read on the page, and they don't really differ a lot from the ones you actually read.
That's true. Does your wife like your humor? I noticed she did not stay for the interview.
She's my severest critic, but she does love it. And you know, it's funny. Everybody has a different favorite piece, which is pleasing to me. And because I think in the book there's something for everyone.
My last question. And I believe this dealt with an organization involving gifted adults. Are you a member of that group?
Are you talking about Mensa?
Yeah, well, that's what Mensa.
I own the distinction of being the humor editor of Mensa, and
they have a magazine, is that correct?
They do. They have a magazine called the Mensa Bulletin, which goes to 50,000 Mensa members in 20 different countries.
These are people who used to be gifted children.
Well, they're people who they're people who have scored in the top 2% on any standardized intelligence test. It was an organization that was set up in 1945 by Sir Cyril Burt, and suggested it over a broadcast on the BBC that an organization be formed, a social organization of intelligent people, to socialize with other intelligent people. And so Mensa was formed, and a lot of people think of it as elitist, but in a sense it's no more elitist than the Campfire Girls. I can't join that, or any medical organization. I can't join that. I'm not a doctor. And they used an IQ test as a means to get in. And it is elitist, and it is snobby, and there are people in it who do nothing but sit around and take pride in their IQs, and there are other people who are a lot of lovely, nice people. It's really, really quite nice organization. They espouse no particular political views or anything like that. They just get together and then let their minds hang out. At any rate, I'm the humor editor of the Bulletin, and I had a few pieces appear in that Bulletin, which appear in the book. And all you Mensa people, get out there and support this book.
Buy this book. Lewis Kirk from Kiss, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.